I have come here to chew bubblegum and kick ass. And I'm all out of bubblegum.
Call me Snake.
The blackest eyes. The devil's eyes. Purely and simply evil.
You're out of your mind,
Wang. God bless you.
What do we do?
Hello out there, and welcome back to Precinct 13, a podcast about the movies, music, and mind of John Carpenter. My name is Nick Rocco Scalia, one of your two co-hosts, joined as always by your other co-host, Chris Oliphant. Chris, I feel like it was just yesterday we were talking about how excited we were to get into the 1980s as a decade of John Carpenter filmmaking. That's obviously when a lot of his best-known and most memorable movies came out of, and now here we are. We're talking today about 1988's They Live, and that's his last movie of the decade. We've covered a lot of ground.
Yeah, he's been a busy guy, and this is also like the end of his most prolific period too.
Yes,
I'm very, very surprised that we are already here, but we are dedicated to the cause, and that is why we are here.
Yeah. So, I mean, getting back to that idea, we talked about this the last episode also. We're talking about this prolific decade. So he starts in 1980 with The Fog, and then almost every year after that, like there's only 2 years. I'm going to try to do this again. I know we've had this conversation before, but like from memory, let's see if we can do the 80s filmography. We've got The Fog in 1980, Escape from New York in 1981, The Thing in 82, which is my favorite. And then that is followed up by Christine in 83. We get Starman in 84.
Correct.
And then he skips 85. He does Big Trouble in Little China in 1986. And then he signs this deal with Alive Films. So he goes from studio films to starting to make kind of lower budget, not exactly independent films again, but smaller scale things. And that begins in 1987 with Prince of Darkness. And then we have 1988's They Live. And then there should be one more film that he did with Alive Films, and that never materialized. We'll talk about that later today. But yeah, so it's 2 years essentially in the 1980s that he takes off from filmmaking. And other than that, he's just a workhorse. It's just nose to the grindstone, whether it's a studio picture or something a little bit more original, something a little bit more his own. He just never stops working.
Yeah, I love that. And it's cool too. I've mentioned to you before that it's this set of movies, Prince of Darkness and They Live, I love so much. And that's, I think, largely due to the fact that he signed this deal where he could make these low budget films and just have like 100% creative control. And while, you know, They Live is a bizarrely different movie than Prince of Darkness, it still is fairly ambitious in its concepts and ideas. And that's part of why I like this movie as well.
Yeah, I mean, this is pure undiluted Carpenter, right? And Prince of Darkness is too. And almost everything he's made up to that point, there's someone else kind of telling him what he can do and what he can't do. And there's always studio interference. I mean, not a lot. I mean, I consider him kind of a maverick director anyway. And even when he's making stuff that is studio for hire work, like Christine, you could definitely see his signature there. And he definitely got his way on a lot of things. But this is just him as writer. He's credited as Frank Armitage here, but that is just John Carpenter himself. Same thing with Prince of Darkness. He wrote that one too. Writer, director, he gets to bring in his own people. Starts up this working relationship with Gary Kibbe, the cinematographer, who ends up working with him on a lot of other films. So, you know, like these films or not, if you're a Carpenter fan, you really do have to check these out, and you really do have to appreciate just how much of him is actually in these movies. And again, it's kind of a shame that we didn't see him continue. Like, his next movie, essentially, his next theatrical feature film is one of his bigger studio productions, 1992's Memoirs of an Invisible Man. We'll get to that one when we get to it, but this, I think, is just a really interesting period in his career, because this almost takes us back to the late 70s, where he's kind of just totally in the driver's seat, and we are getting, like I said, this uncut, undiluted Carpenter vision, for better and for worse. I mean, I wouldn't consider either of these two his best movies, but they might be his most John Carpenter movies, so there's definitely something to be said for that.
Yeah, and this was a minor success as well. We should mention that it did debut at number one at the box office, which is something that probably hadn't happened with for him in, I don't know, maybe ever? Did he ever have a film debut at number one before this?
I think it might be his first number one. Yeah, this movie didn't make a ton of money, but it did leave an impression, at least in those first couple of all-too-important weeks of box office. Right. And again, made on a budget of somewhere between $3 and $4 million. So with, I believe, it was a $14 million take altogether. So again, he's getting back to that profitability that we haven't really seen in a while with his big studio, you know, Big Trouble in Little China and The Thing. These are movies that just don't really have that like immediate impact that something like this does. They gain their cult following later on. This one did both, right? Like, this is a number one when it comes out, and then once we get into sort of VHS and television, which is where I saw it for the first time many, many years ago, and it's been a long, long time. I remembered so little about this movie aside from the concept, but this one kind of hit at the box office and then picked up that cult following. And this is, I mean, I think a lot of people consider this one of his best movies, if not his best movie. And I'm not sure that I'm in that camp. Where do you sit with They Live?
Oh, that's tough. I mean, I guess if we're looking at, you know, I really enjoy this movie, but I don't think I would top five it. I would definitely, I think I would put it in the top half of his films. You know, if I were to put together a ranker, which would be kind of difficult to do because sometimes the way I feel about things can change over time. But I'd say I'd probably put this at maybe seven or eight.
Okay.
Yeah, like, I think that in a way, we were talking about how this film did come out and got, you know, again, a minor success at the box office, and then it later on becomes recognized as this, like, hugely underrated movie. And I was thinking about it, all the conversations we've had and looking at his career so far, I almost think he's sort of like the king of that happening, where like when his movies come out, a lot of them don't do well, a lot of them don't get good reviews, but then like years and years later, they do gain these cult followings. I'm trying to think of another director that has as many movies that have gone through that same kind of treatment historically.
I'm not sure if I can name another one either, especially the way it happens with Carpenter, right? Because it seems much more organic to me. Sometimes a director will make movies and then it'll be the critics. It'll be kind of the academics that years later or decades later, like that kind of happened with film noir, like American film noirs of the 40s. It was the French critics like in the 50s and 60s that saw those low budget films for what they were, which is amazing and really kind of subversive and interesting films. But with Carpenter, it's just like, I think it's people just renting videos and seeing them constantly in syndication on TV, like Big Trouble in Little China was for a long time, and a lot of these movies played a lot on pay cable and stuff like that. And so it was really the people. And I think, you know, Carpenter being the sort of democratic guy that he is, and being sort of a filmmaker for the people, I like that that's the way that happened. Although he did kind of get critical reevaluation over the years also, as we've talked about with some of his other movies.
Yep.
So I think we should probably just get right into this. I will just put out there right up front, this is a part one. This is maybe the last of the two-parters we're going to do. We talked about in the early days of this show that we were going to take some of the quintessential, the key films in the Carpenter filmography, do them in sort of a two-episode fashion rather than just deal with them in one, just because there's so much to talk about. So this episode is going to cover kind of the broad strokes and the overall, basically, pre-production and the film itself and its themes and what happened afterward. And then next time we'll get into a more precise breakdown of the plot and certain scenes and what actually happens in the movie. So we are going to take the big picture approach to this one today, and there might be opportunities in the future. I mean, I could definitely see us doing two episodes on something like In the Mouth of Madness or something like that.
Sure.
But for now, this is the last one we had on that list when we started talking about how we were going to approach all these movies. So I'm really looking forward to getting into it. I think this film is one of those that I'm not sure this is entirely true, but I would say of all of Carpenter's films, this is one of the ones that might be more interesting to talk about than it is to watch, which
interesting.
Some of them have this sort of very immediate visceral quality about them. And I don't know that this one does, but what this one has is some of the biggest ideas that we see across the Carpenter filmography. So I'm looking forward to getting into those. It's a really interesting time in our culture and in our society to be talking about a movie like this. I mean, I've seen it twice in the past few weeks, and we've seen kind of all the upheaval in America and around the world in the last few weeks, and films always have this interesting way of commenting on reality, even if they are films that are as old as this one is. I mean, we're talking about 32 years here, so I think we've got a lot to say. We'll be right back to get into it with They Live.
Masters!
What do these things want, and why are they here?
You still don't get it, do you, boy?
They have recruited the rich and the powerful!
They're running the whole show.
Wake up! They're all about you, all around you. Blinded us to the truth.
Take a look.
They are safe as long as they are not discovered.
I don't know what they are or where they came from, but we gotta stop them.
Stay away from me.
Put these on.
They have us.
Look at them. They're everywhere.
We have no other choice.
I don't like this one bit.
Leave it alone, man. It ain't none of my business. Ain't none of yours.
We have been lulled into a trap.
Listen to what I'm saying to you. We're in trouble. The whole world's in trouble.
All right, we are back, ready to break down They Live from a lot of different angles. Chris, I'll throw it over to you. Where do you want to start with this one? We've got casting decisions that need to be discussed here, and of course, conceptual things and thematic things. So, I mean, we got to get it all in there. Where do you want to begin?
I would first like to begin by asking you what your first memory of this movie was. You mentioned that you saw it on TV years and years ago. How long ago was it when you saw this for the first time?
Oh, decades. Very, very, very long time.
Oh, really?
Yeah. I mean, it's one of those films that I think you see it at a young age. You understand exactly what it is. It is a cult classic, so people are always talking about it. And for whatever reason, I just hadn't really revisited it until just recently for the show. But my first memory of it is when I was a little kid, just kind of scrolling through the TV, but flipping the actual physical pages of a TV guide.
And adjusting the antennas.
Yeah. Just kind of seeing it that way, seeing that this was a thing that was going to be on, or I probably caught it in the middle and then looked it up in the TV guide, like, ooh, what is this? Because you didn't even have a cable guide on the screen back then. Yep. But at the time, I was just a junkie for like anything that was sci-fi, horror, action, and this is all of those things. I maybe didn't get the politics of it quite as much. I mean, I'm talking about like single-digit age. I was probably 9 years old or 10 years old or something like that. So,
wow.
You know, I was devouring everything that was anywhere near this genre, so like The Terminator and The Hidden and those kind of movies. So this looked like that kind of thing, and I definitely watched it then. I knew who Rowdy Roddy Piper was, so it was cool to. I wasn't a huge wrestling fan when I was a kid, but it was big enough back in the day where I kind of knew who these people were. So yeah, I mean, my memories of it were very sketchy, and seeing it play out, actually watching it as an adult and as someone who has seen the entire Carpenter filmography up to this point until now, it was definitely more interesting to my older self. But I think I enjoyed it as a kid. I remember liking it. You know, I know if someone had asked me about it in all those years intervening, I would have said, yeah, that movie's awesome. How about you? Where did you start out with this movie?
You know, Nick, I wanted to mention that I remember when I was very young when this movie came out, because I was born in 82, so I would have been 6 years old when this came out. And I remember going to the movie store, you know, I don't even think it was Blockbuster yet. It was like Video Galaxy or something. And I very specifically remember seeing just the cover art for this. And also looking through old like TV guide magazines, I always remember just the sunglasses with the reflection of the, you know, skeletal looking alien face. And then just something about the title. The title and like the font that they used on it, it really grabbed my attention, and I always remembered it, but for some reason I never watched the movie. And then when I started getting into looking into John Carpenter a little bit more, I was like, oh my god, They Live is one of his movies. I felt so kind of embarrassed that I didn't know that, and I think I saw it for the first time about 4 or 5 years ago.
Okay.
And I've probably seen the movie 4 or 5 times in total now. But yeah, it wasn't until way later on in life that I saw this, and I'm kind of grateful for that because I was at least able to sort of embrace some of the concepts that this movie was trying to wrestle with.
Yeah,
no pun intended.
This is definitely a movie. Perfect. This is a movie for grown-ups, I think. And although I enjoyed it as a kid, like I was saying, I don't think I completely got it. And definitely seeing it as an older person, I mean, like I said, this is one of his big ideas movies. I mean, this is as close to a capital M message movie as Carpenter ever made. And there's satire in Dark Star, and there's little political things all over the place in some of his other movies. But yeah, I mean, certain filmmakers, right? And we've talked about this before. I know you're a big Oliver Stone guy. And to me, when you go see an Oliver Stone movie, you expect to be kind of preached to a little bit. I mean, he is a message movie guy. So when he makes something that's not essentially a political film or a message movie or something that is really strongly ideological, that's a shocker, right? Like, I remember going to see World Trade Center by Oliver Stone when that first came out. And when I first read that he was making a 9/11 movie, I was like, wow, this is going to be the most subversive, really controversial 9/11 movie of anybody's. And it turned out to not be that at all. It's a very straightforward story about just first responders, and a true story about first responders and just sort of the immediate things that they did to save lives in 9/11. And it had
so much of that movie is just them like trapped in the rubble.
Yeah, great Nicolas Cage performance too. I'm a huge Cage guy, and that's one of his more straightforward roles. But yeah, I mean, there's very little politics in that movie. There's very little ideology, but that's a strange thing from Oliver Stone, right? Like every once in a while, he'll turn out a U-turn or something like that, where it's not JFK. It's not something that's trying to get you to rethink history. Whereas with John Carpenter, when he makes a message movie, it's like, oh, that's not the thing that he does. So it becomes kind of an outlier in his filmography. So it's the opposite thing. And this one is definitely that. I love that poster you were talking about. I mean, it really, it's a great concept that this movie has, and that poster just kind of sells it in one image. It's perfect. Like the eye behind the sunglasses and that alien face that is very 50s sci-fi, very Mars Attacks. And I think that's definitely an influence here. The font, the title even, They Live, is a very 50s sci-fi, almost Twilight Zone kind of thing. And we see that kind of recurring throughout this whole film. I mean, there are black and white sequences here. So I feel like Carpenter's not only getting out some very specific points about 80s consumer culture, but he's also paying tribute to like some of the movies that might have scared him when he was a kid and stuff that he saw like at the drive-in or on television and things like that. And he's done that, of course, before with The Thing, is a direct remake essentially of a classic 1950s horror film. But here it's a little bit campier and a little bit more obvious that he is paying tribute to that era.
That's a really awesome analysis. And I guess we should talk about maybe just the development of it. I know I saw, and also from listening to his director commentary on the Blu-ray that I have, he mentions the short story, which you told me off air you've read, called 8 o'clock in the Morning by Ray Nelson.
Yes.
Okay. And that was published in like a science fiction magazine.
Yeah, it's like a pulp story. It's about 5.5 pages long. You can find it on the internet if you want to read it. And actually, I mean, it's strange how accurate this film is to that story, because it is so much older and because there's not a lot of meat on the bones of that story. Like, that story basically just is concept and then action and then it's over. But it is about this race of aliens that has taken over the world, basically. And in that story, the sunglasses are not a part of it. They don't exist. The character is hypnotized. His name is Nada, which is the name of Rowdy Roddy Piper's. I'm going to call him that, by the way. I can't just call him Roddy Piper. He is Rowdy Roddy Piper. If you put an adjective at the beginning of your name, I'm going to use it. Sorry, Weird Al Yankovic, but that's the way it is. but like, that character is hypnotized and he comes out of hypnosis, and that is the catalyst for him to pull back the veil and see this alien world that exists among us. And of course, they're all then out to get him. And a lot of the things in that story, aside from the hypnosis and not having the sunglasses, they kind of play out the way they do in this movie. Some of the slogans and the phrases that we see on the advertising in this film, which is a big part of They Live, you know, this obey, consume, this kind of messaging that the alien civilization has basically put all over the place and taken over our advertising to get those messages out there. A lot of that exact phrasing is there in the story. So really what Carpenter does is flesh this out. He gives us a lot more character and a lot more character development. He gives us that amazing device of the sunglasses, these sort of special sunglasses that let you see beyond the veil and see what these aliens actually look like and what they're actually up to. And he takes what is basically a straightforward story. I mean, it's the original short story doesn't have a lot of political subtext of its own. I mean, there's definitely something going on there. It's from like 1963, so we're kind of at the height of the Cold War, and we do have this fear of the outsider and things like that, and fear of these sort of, you know, like a communist society where everyone is kind of exactly the same. So I think that's reflected a lot in the 60s story, and Carpenter's version of this, his take on it, is really taking on consumer culture and this idea of money making over everything else and profits over people kind of thing. And the aliens in his story, the reason why they're here is to basically use up America and use up the entire world, but starting in America, which is a very consumerist culture anyway, and kind of expend all its resources and then move on, leave it kind of just a hulk and a shell of itself. So he adds, I think, some really interesting subtext to it. He obviously adds some really interesting plotting to it. We get some fight scenes that are not even suggested in the story. I mean, one of the most famous fight scenes in all of movies is here in They Live. It's probably the best scene in the movie. It's certainly my favorite scene in the movie. So yeah, I mean, that was the beginning of it, a pulp story from the 60s, also adapted into a comic book years later. But he really takes it and runs with it, which is kind of an interesting thing. And it is, again, it's his script as Frank Armitage.
Yep. Yeah. So it's really the whole inception of this movie is a combination of several different influences. And then towards the end of the movie, it kind of turns into an action movie, right?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. So, yeah, the genesis of this is really interesting. And then I think, as you were kind of talking about before, that, you know, this being his movie with a message with a capital M. Yeah, I think that's a really interesting theme, the entire just kind of political aspect to it. And John Carpenter's been very, he's very blunt about, you know, his political stance and how essentially he was just inspired by the 1980s. And Reaganomics, and I mean, he essentially just says that these are a bunch of like Republican aliens.
Yeah.
You know, it was kind of at that point where Wall Street is ushered in, and there's, you know, big, big money, and just a lot of problems economically with homeless people, employment rate, stuff like that. And he was just so angered at kind of like the overall material culture. And decided, I mean, obviously felt strongly enough about it to want to inject that kind of ideology into one of his movies, which I think is really cool.
Yeah, and not only that, I mean, I read some quotes from him about this, and this is coming out in 1988, and that was Reagan is just coming out of office, and the election is between Republican George H.W. Bush, and the Democrat was it Michael Dukakis, I think? I'm pretty sure this is the first election I actually remember. Like, I was in first grade or something, and they were like, yep, who do you want to vote for? And I don't know, I think Bush won in my class, but we didn't know what the hell we were talking about. I remember, yeah, my grandmother was a big Dukakis supporter, but Carpenter basically said he wanted to affect the results of that election. Like, he wanted people to see this movie and then not vote for Bush after having seen this movie, which is kind of a ballsy thing for a filmmaker to do and to say. And I think it comes back to this idea, him working with this smaller company with Alive Films, they'll give him the leeway to do something like that, right? Like, this really anti-corporate, anti-consumerist movie. I think if I'm the head of like a Paramount or a Universal Studios or something like that, I'm gonna be like, no, like, you're talking shit about us by doing that. You can't make this movie. It obviously got major distribution, but I don't think, it was distributed by Universal, but it was not produced by Universal or in-house at Universal. And I don't think a bigger company is necessarily gonna let you make a movie like this without toning it down or without kind of taking a slightly different approach. I mean, Oliver Stone's Wall Street, you just mentioned Wall Street as a place, and also that is a film that is really indicative of what this era was like, and that's a big studio movie, but I don't think you're going to get a lot of those made, so this was definitely a sort of maverick thing that Carpenter did here.
Yeah, and also someone, like, I think someone in Stone's case, I mean, he was coming off Platoon at the time, so he could pretty much do whatever he wanted to.
Well, Carpenter was coming off Prince of Darkness, which was not a hit.
That is such a funny comparison to make.
No Academy Awards for Prince of Darkness, sadly.
Right. Yeah, like, dude, you bring up such a good point. I found a movie poster for They Live, and it says right on the top of the poster, the left-hand side, it says, you see them on the street, you watch them on TV, you might even vote for one this fall. You think they're people just like you. You're wrong, dead wrong.
That's a great tagline.
Yeah, it is. But I mean, it's very, like I said, I used the word blunt before. I just think it's very upfront. It's pretty heavy-handed, but...
unless you're like an 8-year-old, like I was the first time I saw this movie, or a 9-year-old, yeah, you're going to get it. Like, this movie's not subtle in its political subtext at all. It's not even a subtext. It's really the text.
Yeah, and I love, too, how in this other interview I saw with John Carpenter, he just said, you know, I hate authority. I hate authority in all forms, like, unless I'm the one with the authority. And he's like, kind of like, there, I said it kind of thing. And I see what he's saying, because we've talked about how he does have anti-authoritarian themes in a lot of his other movies as well. And sometimes it's subtle. Sometimes it's more subtle than it is other times, and this one is certainly not. So, and again, I'm in favor of that, and I think it makes the movie just a little bit more interesting. You said something that got me thinking. You're like, this may be like the only movie he's made that is actually more fun to talk about than it is to watch. It's a very interesting analysis, because I get what you mean by that. Absolutely.
Yeah. I mean, it's not that I dislike this movie. I mean, I think it's a good film overall, but when we talk about like quintessential Carpenter moments, right? I mean, there's so many of those just scattered across this filmography, and here the great fight scene between Rowdy Roddy Piper and Keith David, certainly that's in there. That's in the book of all time classic Carpenter scenes. And I think, you know, we were talking about a couple of days ago about the initial scene where Nada puts the glasses on and sort of sees the world for what it really is. I mean, that might be in there too. But as far as like the action sequences here, and as far as just the filmmaking style and the way scenes are set up and the way things play out, I wouldn't put this among like his best filmmaking efforts, right? Like, it's not his most entertaining movie, but it is one of his most thoughtful movies. It's one of his most just sort of aggressively in your face ideological movies. So yeah, I mean, I think it might be more interesting to talk about, but I mean, it's not a bad film, it's not a boring film to watch at all. I mean, there is, like you said, it does kind of have a lot of interesting action beats. There are like siege sequences in this movie that kind of remind me of things like Assault in Precinct 13 and Escape from New York. There's there's like an escape through an alleyway in this movie, and people shooting at the characters. There's cops shooting at the characters from rooftops in the alleyway. And that reminded me, it was almost like a direct copy of the opening moments of Assault in Precinct 13. So it does call back in some ways to the earlier films. Certainly some walls get broken through in this movie, because over the weeks I've found that that is kind of the key thing in the entire Carpenter directorial canon, is just lots of walls down.
Helicopters and the destruction of walls.
Totally, helicopters. Yeah, lots of them.
Yeah, so, like, it's really funny because you mentioned the siege element in this movie, and you're like, yeah, that kind of reminded me of Assault on Precinct 13 and Halloween and The Thing and Escape from New York and Prince of Darkness and Big Trouble. I mean, that's just like an ever-present theme in practically all his movies.
Yeah, although this is also kind of a chase movie, which is not something that he normally does.
Right.
I mean, a lot of his action films take place in an isolated location, like the ones we were just talking about, obviously The Thing. Assault in Precinct 13, like, that's the whole concept. This is one of those, like, man-on-the-run kind of movies where once Nada discovers what's going on and he starts to be pursued and he just starts straight-up killing people, which we'll probably talk about that more next episode, but this movie kind of takes off like a shot. Like, there's a moment when it goes from kind of slow and almost contemplative to just sort of non-stop, like, running and shooting and pursuit, whereas a lot of those other films kind of stay stationary for a long time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so why don't we just get into the casting now while we're on it?
Oh,
because
yeah.
I think that the choice of Rowdy Roddy Piper is such an interesting one, and apparently Mr. Carpenter is a big fan of wrestling, because I heard through the grapevine that they met at a WrestleMania, and essentially the next thing you know, he has a role in this film. As you mentioned, as very interestingly named Nada, which was derived from the comic book, right?
From the original story also. Yep.
The original story. Okay. And then Keith David, obviously, he had worked with before on The Thing. And I love it. We get some more Carpenter name play here. Who Keith David is playing a character, Frank Armitage, which is the name that Carpenter used as the writer for this movie.
Yes, and is also the name of a protagonist in one of the H.P. Lovecraft stories, and we know that Carpenter is a big Lovecraft fan and basically makes a straight-up Lovecraft movie that in everything but name and In the Mouth of Madness, and has been sort of kicking around those influences for a long time. And this, again, and Carpenter has said this too, this is a movie about these sort of things behind the world that we see, and that's a very Lovecraftian idea. We have to talk about, we were talking about moments earlier, like sort of quintessential Carpenter moments, and one of them is just this line of dialogue in this movie that still, I heard it quoted on a podcast today. They were talking about stuff that's going on in the world right now, and it's Piper's line, "I've come here to chew bubblegum and kick ass, and I'm all out of bubblegum." And that was actually Rowdy Roddy Piper's, like, that's a line that he came up with for a wrestling promo that he was shooting, you know, the sort of backstage thing that professional wrestlers do where they talk shit about each other and, of course, do it in really interesting and colorful ways. And Carpenter said, we have to use that in the movie. That's exactly what this character would say. So, yeah, I mean, there is a little bit of that professional wrestling feel here. And I don't know, like, I want to say this is one of the first major movies that starred WWF superstar in the leading role. I mean, I know there's been plenty since, and obviously The Rock has had a pretty amazing film career, and Stone Cold Steve Austin has been in movies. Hulk Hogan's been in a number of really terrible movies, and a year before this, you get Andre the Giant in The Princess Bride, which might be my favorite wrestler performance in a movie. Mm. But yeah, this is not really a thing you saw much before this. And certainly not in this capacity, I don't think.
Yeah, and I've never even seen anything else that Roddy Piper has been in, even though I know he has a lot of acting credits. I know he did mention on the commentary that I listened to that this was kind of like the biggest movie that he was ever in, you know, getting the lead role and everything. And interestingly enough, I just thought of this. We were talking about Oliver Stone before. Keith David was in Platoon just the year prior.
Yep.
So this, he might have probably just came off of Platoon and did They Live with John Carpenter. But yeah, I see your point there. I just think it's a really interesting casting call, because I mean, listen, I think Rowdy Roddy Piper is awesome in this movie. I mean, I don't think he's like a, you know, tremendous actor, but I think he fits this character very well, and I think that him and Keith David have a really good chemistry.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, Rowdy Roddy Piper is not a thespian. I mean, he's okay. His line deliveries are not terrible, but he's got more presence than he does acting skill, and that's okay. I mean, his character is kind of a blank slate. He's kind of a cipher. We don't know a ton about him, and actually, I have a theory about that. I don't know if we'll get to it this episode, but I have some thoughts about Nada and where he comes from. He's never named in the movie, by the way. We don't know his name until the end credits, but yeah, I mean, it's a great sort of buddy team-up duo thing that ends up happening with him and Keith David. Of course, Keith David was in The Thing. He's really great in that as Childs, and Carpenter wrote this part for him, and I really like Keith David brings this kind of presence to his roles where he's kind of just an average guy who's also a real badass when he needs to be. Like, he's not an over-the-top kind of actor. Like, he doesn't need to say a lot to sort of intimidate you or to just, like, let you know that you shouldn't mess with him. And I think mm-hmm. he really gets that across in this movie really well. I mean, he should have been an action star. Like, I know he's had a really great career and he's done a lot of movies since then and before then, but like I would have loved to have seen him sort of top line some action movies, particularly during this period where action movies were just sort of go for broke, bloody, shoot 'em up, you know, the Lethal Weapons and diehards of the world. I would have liked to have seen him capitalize on that image a little bit more.
He's a hard worker. I was just looking at his acting credits on IMDb. I mean, the guy has over 300 credits. It's like he's just constantly in TV shows and movies.
His voice. I mean, he was, I was just watching, I think it was Rick and Morty, and he was just doing some voice acting on that. And I'm like, oh, that's Keith David. Like, he has a very distinctive voice. And I think I've heard him in commercials and stuff like that. But yeah, this is his second Carpenter movie. And I'm sorry that there weren't more of them, because I think they do work well together. And obviously, they had a good relationship if you wanted to bring him back. But that's Carpenter, right? I mean, he likes who he likes and he loves to work with the same people. Again, this is the second film for Gary Kibbe as a cinematographer. We've got Peter Jason back from Prince of Darkness,
yes.
who goes on to make more movies. Yeah, and he's really good in this. Like, he doesn't have much to do in Prince of Darkness. He's just sort of this not really interesting scientist guy who has, you know, he's got a little bit of, like, snark and sarcasm to him in that movie, but here he's kind of one of the leaders of the resistance and actually has some dramatic stuff to do, and I really like him in this.
Yeah, but he doesn't do that cool whistling thing in this movie that he does in Prince of Darkness.
That should have been his trademark. Yeah, you're right.
Meg Foster.
The lovely Meg Foster. I remember her very well from a movie called Leviathan that came out, I think, a year after this, that was a total ripoff of, like, The Thing and The Abyss. It's like an underwater alien horror movie. And I used to watch that one constantly when I was a kid. I was saying before, I was just really into that genre. And so it was really neat to see her here. Like, she's another one that I would have expected to have been a bigger star. Like, she's good in this, and she definitely has the kind of image that would have fit really well you know, in these kinds of movies. But we don't really see a lot of her in these big genre productions.
All underground stuff, man. And
well, Roddy Piper, too. Like, I remember seeing his face on a lot of videos at the video store in the early 90s. We're making ourselves sound so old, by the way. We got to stop talking about that. But again, this is a John Carpenter podcast. A lot of his fans are probably around our age. I mean, I hope there's younger ones, but.
Have you seen Meg Foster in those Rob Zombie movies?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Time has not been kind to everyone. Keith David looks great.
Yeah.
He hasn't aged a day, but yeah, some of these actors, and of course, Roddy Piper passed away a couple of years ago, which is pretty sad, because I think he probably still had some more movies in him. I mean, he continuously worked up until he died.
And can we talk about George Buckflower, please?
Yeah, of course, because we're going to need to.
This is the guy I say this in jest, but imagine doing a podcast on this guy. He is in so many movies and a lot of 80s slasher films, but he's the guy in The Fog who I love when he says the line, "I don't see no fog out there. I don't see no fog out there. Hey, there's fog out there." I don't know why that just cracks me up every time.
That scene is fantastic.
Yep.
I'm just sort of looking over his filmography right now. So it looks like he started out in, like, the softcore porn world, because he made some movies with titles like The Sex Prophet and Orgy American Style, and this might be my favorite. I think I might need to seek this movie out. He was in a movie called Succula, and he played a character named George Smutman.
I'm looking at that right now.
He's also in The Erotic Adventures of Pinocchio in 1971. So definitely a colorful career that this guy had. And yeah, he is returning from some earlier Carpenter films. He was in Escape from New York. And he is in Prince of Darkness? Or he's not in Prince of Darkness?
I don't believe so.
I don't see it here.
No, but he comes back in some of the... like, I know he's in Village of the Damned, which I just verified here. It's been a while since I've seen that one. I don't know if he has a major role in it, but, you know, you got to love it. The stuff like Puppet Master 2. Let's see, what else is he in? Apparently he's in Back to the Future 2. I mean, he's in a lot of different movies. I thought there was another Carpenter movie that he's in, though.
Starman. He is in Starman.
There we go. Starman. Yep.
So
okay.
he did some of the studio stuff with him and also some of the smaller scale things. Yeah, I mean, this is a really good cast, and I think a lot
of Body
these...
Bags, too.
Oh, I can't wait to see Body Bags. That's one of those that's on my must-see list because we're getting to it soon. Yeah. So we do get these returning cast members. We get a couple of interesting new faces to the Carpenter universe. And then this is kind of a little bit of a breaking off point also. Like, we've been talking a lot about these films that kind of launched partnerships. And this is one where certain people no longer were part of the fold. They sort of left the Carpenter family. I'm thinking of the producer Larry Franco, who had been with him for a long time. This is the last Larry Franco production. And I don't know. I mean, there's probably all kinds of behind the scenes stories and, you know, like just relationships that dissolved and things like that. But we don't see Keith David again either, right?
No, that's a huge bummer. Yeah. I mean, Larry Franco, he's still doing his musical collaborations with Alan Howarth. And I think this might actually be the last collaboration that they did together.
Yeah. I think this is their last movie together, although they have continued to make music together.
Well, what happened was, I mean, because I know he came on for Escape from New York, but I mean, later on, you know, he would go back to kind of remaster and revitalize, if you will, some of the older scores, like Assault on Precinct 13 and The Fog for re-release, because obviously there's a lot of different, there's numerous pressings for pretty much all these records, but this, yeah, the music in this one was composed by John Carpenter, as it always says, in association with Alan Howarth. And we get the normal approach that Carpenter takes, that they just kind of improvised score, which I know we touched on this a little bit on the anthology episode we did, but I find the music in this particular film very, I don't want to use the word off-kilter, but just, I don't know if it always fits. And don't get me wrong, I love the music itself, and I do listen to the soundtrack from time to time. But it just seems like such an odd choice in this movie. I would have, especially a movie that has such a heavy and like dark idea to it, I would have loved a little bit more of the traditional weapons that he uses. Like, there's hardly any synthesizer in this. I mean, it's like, it's kind of this bluesy shuffle kind of sounding thing with like harmonicas and acoustic guitar. So I don't know. I don't get me wrong, I appreciate the music 100%. I think John Carpenter's an amazing composer, but it's just an odd fit for this movie.
Yeah, it is. I mean, I would say that it fits really well with maybe the first act or the first half even of this film, where it's basically like, one of the things I really like about this movie is you don't know anything from the beginning about what this is going to be. I mean, obviously you've seen the poster and you know what you're getting into, but if you're just going into this completely blind, this is a film about a drifter who ends up in a homeless encampment and is looking for work, and there's some weird stuff kind of going on in the background with the televisions that everyone is watching, and just some things that let us know that not everything is right in the world. But because this movie is kind of about working class people and the urban poor, and it's a story of a homeless person, it kind of fits that really well. Like, this film has a really, really great opening shot. It's actually one of my favorites in all of Carpenter, where we see this graffiti covered railroad bridge and the train is passing by and the camera dollies over from right to left. And then we see Rowdy Roddy Piper. We see him kind of in the background waiting for the train to pass, and he's got like his pack on him, so we know that he's homeless, we know that he doesn't have a place to stay and he's looking for one. And I think it fits that really well, right? Like, it's this guy who's kind of living this very traditional hobo kind of lifestyle, and so the bluesy stuff really works well for that. But then when this movie sort of takes off, as I was saying, and becomes a chase film and an action film and a siege film, it doesn't really fit that. And I do kind of, I'm looking for something more like the Escape from New York soundtrack for the second half of this film, and it doesn't really do that.
Right, and I think coming off of Prince of Darkness, like, that's the compatibility between the music and the film in that is just so good.
I love that score so much. Yeah, with the church organ and the sort of very religious feel to it. Yep. Yeah.
Yeah, it's horrifying. So where do we go from here? I mean, this thing was filmed in L.A., you know, as we mentioned before, on a pretty small budget, $3 million. Movie makes $14 million in the box office. So not killing it, but at least making money and not losing money like some of his movies. Big Trouble in Little China, I think, was basically a failure at the box office straight up.
Yeah. And the thing was, too, I mean, this movie, I must say, like, in terms of production design and in terms of settings and set pieces, this doesn't look like a cheap movie, right? I mean, there are really sort of harrowing moments where they're basically, the cops are coming into this homeless encampment and they've got helicopters and bulldozers and, like, they're just tearing this place apart. I mean, there are some kind of big scale scenes here, so it doesn't look like a cheap movie.
No.
It doesn't look like a low budget movie, and it mostly takes place in LA, so we do get a lot of, like, outdoor shots. I mean, it's not one of those movies that's sort of a confined location. It's not an Assault in Precinct 13 where, you know, most of the LA stuff is kind of just like second unit kind of footage where we don't actually get the sense that the actors were necessarily there and they were filming on location. I mean, there's a lot of LA stuff in this movie, and particularly the sequence we were talking about before, where Nada puts the glasses on for the first time and then goes into the bank and says his famous line. I mean, those are all real locations. I mean, there's a lot of production value. He really squeezes a lot out of that $3 million, I feel like.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. The picture looks great. This, you know, as much as I adore the work that Dean Cundey did as a cinematographer, this Gary B. Kibbe guy is no slouch. He definitely knows how to shoot a good looking picture.
And he gets to do the black and white stuff here, which I think is always fun. You know, I do a little bit of camera work in my job also, and it's always sort of neat to just work in that mode and think like a cinematographer, you know, 60, 70 years ago, where you don't have the full color palette to work with. And it's just such a cool visual device that this film does, where once you put the glasses on, you see the world in black and white, and black and white is actually the truth. That's what you should be seeing, and the color is all just kind of a veil over that. And yeah, I mean, he does some great stuff. Also, like I was mentioning, those sequences where the cops start bursting in on the characters, it happens a couple of times here, which again kind of is an interesting parallel to things that are happening in the world right now. But like that scene where they basically destroy the homeless encampment, and it's just like red and blue flashing lights everywhere and helicopters flying around, and that's all really, really well shot, and kind of the atmosphere of it is just very intense and harrowing, and the lighting and the cinematography really adds to that.
Yeah, there's some straight up like police brutality in this movie. There's that scene where, like, you know, there's a couple cops like beating up some guy with a bunch of billy clubs, and you know, this was before Rodney King and all that happened.
Really kind of looks forward towards stuff like that.
Yep. And it's, you know, it's a little sad, but the movie also does have kind of a comic element to it. You know, it's a little lighthearted at times, I feel. Do you sense that at all?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a campiness to this movie that you don't necessarily see across the Carpenter filmography. And it kind of, like, it starts to take hold and then increases more and more. Like I was saying earlier, the first half hour or so of this movie, I mean, parts of it just kind of look like a social realist drama. Like, this is a movie about homeless people and people looking for work. And then as we sort of move on into this alien thing, which is the key to the movie, yeah, I do think it gets campier and campier. And then the closing scene of this, like the last few minutes of this movie, they're just straight up played for laughs, which is really interesting. I mean, it's some of the silliest stuff that you see since, you know, what, Big Trouble in Little China or Dark Star. I mean, it's kind of more of a Dark Star satirical thing that it's doing, but it is really, really played for comedy.
Yep. Yeah, no doubt. And, you know, I think one other thing that's important to consider about this movie is just sort of its legacy. I would be interested to have. Did you read Roger Ebert's review on this?
I did not. That's usually where I start. And I didn't want to do it this time just because I feel like I'm always talking about Roger Ebert on the show. So I wanted to go in like completely unaware of what he had to say.
I was hoping that you did, because I was okay. Like 100% sure that you probably did. Maybe we'll make that a homework assignment for next time, because I'd be curious to see what he had to say. He's not a huge Carpenter fan. He's usually coming in, you know, in the 2 to 3 star range. Oddly enough, he's a very big fan of Escape from L.A. But, you know, I think at the time, the consensus on this movie was pretty mixed, where some people, like, understood the storytelling and, you know, and understood, like, the central concept of the film. And then there were a lot of negative reviews, though, that were hating on the acting and just, you know, kind of saying that the movie was just, like, wildly inconsistent. And even the concept itself was criticized. Years and years later, I mean, this sucker sits at 86% on Rotten Tomatoes out of 63 reviews. This has a higher score on Rotten Tomatoes, just using that as a reference of reviews, because, you know, I get it. It's different how they calculate their scores. If it's, like, fresh, if it's above 60%, you know, it's either fresh or rotten.
Yeah.
So 86% of the reviews were fresh. That's going to be higher up than most other Carpenter films. I think there's probably only 3 or 4 other films. Like, I know Assault on Precinct 13 is ridiculous. It's like 98. I know Halloween's probably around 90. I think maybe The Thing is in the 80s. But in some ways, out of all 20 of his films, this one has some of the most favorable reviews.
Yeah, it's one of the more critically acclaimed. And I think a lot of that, oftentimes with not just this film, but a lot of films. I mean, some critics just really like the politics of a movie so much that they'll be willing to overlook some of the more technical choices or aesthetic choices that it makes because it has a message that they really like. And we certainly see that a lot today also. But like you were mentioning Rotten Tomatoes and the very high rating it has there. It's got 52 on Metacritic, which is sort of averages out scores in a more precise way. And there is no sort of fresh rotten kind of distinction. So I thought that was interesting. Like, a lot of the reviews from when this came out criticized this film, not for what it was trying to say necessarily, but just that it's maybe not his most dynamic film and not his best filmmaking, and maybe the message kind of gets in the way of some of those things. There is,
sure,
right here, it's quoted on the Wikipedia page for this movie, Janet Maslin, who wrote for the New York Times. She said, "Since Mr. Carpenter seems to be trying to make a real point here, the flatness of They Live is doubly disappointing. So is its crazy inconsistency, since the film stops trying to abide even by its own game plan after a while." And, you know, like, that's such critic speak, right? I am a film critic, so I can't completely, you know, those are my people. So I don't want to just, like, destroy, particularly an esteemed critic like Janet Maslin. But, I mean, one of the things I sort of like about this movie is that, yeah, it doesn't really play even by its own rules, and we never really know what to expect. And it starts out as a very different movie as it ends up, as we were just saying. And, you know, I don't think that's necessarily a bad thing all the time, particularly because I do think the message comes through so clearly that it doesn't matter. You know, it's just kind of taking different approaches to this same core idea about capitalism and consumerism and, you know, the ravages of sort of unchecked political power for people who maybe shouldn't have it.
Yeah, I mean, I could tell you my favorite thing about the movie right now, and it's just absolutely the effect that we get in black and white when Rowdy Roddy Piper first puts the glasses on, and like that the first time you see what he sees behind the sunglasses and the way, I mean, it's filmed like so tightly, right? Like, it just shows him. And as soon as he lifts the glasses down and just looks without, you know, not looking through the lenses anymore, and it goes back to the image and it just changes immediately. I thought that was done so well. And it's kind of the first point in the, it's the first point in the movie where you go, whoa, that's cool.
Yeah.
You know, and it just, it rides with that, that scene in the grocery store there. And I don't know, just the aesthetic of that and that whole kind of sequence there where we first are introduced to, this actually gives me visibility to be able to see these aliens or whatever, that's probably some of my favorite stuff out of everything that we've watched so far.
Yeah, I mean, it's a great visual, and it's not just like, right, so the people look like these skull-faced aliens. That's a great effect. Like I was saying before, I think that's a real throwback sort of look that they have, and they're not the sort of gloppy, special effect-y 80s aliens. You know, like a lot of movies from this period, they kind of went overboard with just the gruesomeness and the elaborateness of the special effects, and these are a lot simpler. They seem to come from that like 50s Twilight Zone Star Trek kind of era where aliens just look like people in masks, and you definitely get that sense here. But also just the advertising, right? Like they go out and shoot in LA and these places that are just surrounded by billboards and magazine covers and, you know, like posters and things like that, and every one of them is part of this alien agenda where when you put the glasses on, you just see these very simplistic messages: obey, consume, what's it, work 8 hours, sleep 8 hours, whatever that one is, marry and procreate. So you know, this movie, if it does nothing else, it really shows just how inundated our society is with advertising. And, you know, I was kind of thinking about They Live as like, is this a movie we need to remake because media has changed so much and sort of politically and ideologically we've changed so much? I don't know. Like, what do you think? Is this a film that kind of still has important points to make about 2020? Or is this one that is kind of ripe for a remake treatment because we just sort of approach these things in a different way? I mean, it's an interesting film to look at just from like a media studies perspective, for example.
It is. And I think that, I mean, to answer your question, I wouldn't like to see this movie be remade. And while I do think there is like, there's some stuff about this movie that are very much 80s in like a corny kind of a way. So maybe things like that could be modernized a little bit, but I think the concepts that this movie is talking about are still very much relevant today. And I think a lot of the economic policies and just the whole political atmosphere in general hasn't changed at all. So if anything, I would say this movie is sort of like hauntingly relevant now, probably more now than it was then. And without being too serious about it, you know, that's the thing. So I don't want to see this movie get remade.
I don't really want to see any movie get remade. I mean, unless it's a bad movie. I wish they'd remake bad movies into good movies, but they never do that. They take good movies and kind of make lesser versions of them. But they're redoing all the Carpenter films at this point. I mean, we've been talking so much on this show about things that they are just so eager to do another version of. And I'm surprised. Like, I know there was a remake of this planned, I think, like around 10 years ago or something like that, and it never materialized. But I don't know. I mean, there's some interesting directions you could go with it. But yeah, you were mentioning before, like there's some anger toward the police in this movie, and there's images of police brutality. And one of the first things that Nada does when he basically sees the world for what it is he's pursued by the police. That's right after that grocery store scene, and he just starts killing cops, which is a pretty subversive image for a movie, particularly in the Law and Order 80s era. But, you know, definitely speaks to what's going on and sort of frustration and anger with the police that's happening right now in 2020. And there's just some really startling and sort of striking images. And some of the other stuff, too, the less, you know, maybe intense stuff, just the homelessness and the joblessness. And there are parts of, you know, we see the city kind of for what it is. I mean, cities are going through this real transitional period right now that may result in a lot more of that in the near future. So yeah, I mean, there's some timely things for us right now. And of course, we've had the president that we've had for the last few years, and there are some similarities to the 80s there as well.
Yeah, and
I'd love to know, like, what do you think John Carpenter thinks of Donald Trump?
Oh, I'm sure he's not a fan.
He should make a movie about it then. That's what he does. Come back, John Carpenter.
Oh, man. Yeah, what would that be called?
I don't know.
Anyway. No, I like... I think, in a nutshell, at the end of the day, what I appreciate about this movie a lot is that it does have some strong messages and some strong lessons in there, but it's still a fun movie to watch. It's not like... this is going to be totally serious, you know, and you have to pay attention to every single detail. I mean, you really don't. This movie's just kind of a fun movie to watch. And, you know, the whole idea of aliens and just brainwashing and the whole connection to consumerism and thought control, mass media, you know, the signaling, like when they're getting the headaches, when they're watching the television, and just, I don't know, there's kind of, in a way, like Prince of Darkness, he's got this whole, like, bag of ideas that he's kind of flirting with, and I think it's a pretty nice cocktail overall. You know, again, it's not a movie that I'm like, you know, I don't know. I mean, I'm just a big fan of his work anyway. I'd probably watch this movie once a year and be fine with it, you know?
Yeah. It's definitely a fun movie. It's not one of those message movies that beats you over the head with its message and then just has nothing else to offer. I mean, it's fast-paced. It's a lot of fun in a lot of parts. There is that great fight scene that I guess we'll probably get to that next episode. I want to devote a lot of time to that. We're kind of coming around to the end here, and it's a long enough fight scene. I want to spend at least 6.5 minutes or however long it actually is talking about it, because I think it deserves that. But there are a lot of moments, you know, that are interesting. I mean, it's not always like the best action sequences Carpenter has ever done. Like, there are a lot of shots in this film of just Roddy Piper firing an assault rifle, like, basically at nothing, and then he just sort of, you cut to the reverse shot and he's hitting people, and they're not sort of as dynamically choreographed and as well done as stuff that we see elsewhere. But it is, it's an interesting sort of fun, funny, very fast-paced movie that, yeah, I mean, I think a lot of things about it they make it not a chore to watch. So even if you are a really sort of anti-consumerist person and you're seeking out content that sort of has a similar worldview to what you have, this is not like, you know, it's kind of a junk food movie as well as a nutritious movie. And it's kind of rare to see that, because a lot of message movies are just sort of stone-faced and serious. And this is definitely not that, particularly as we were saying as it goes on. You mentioned television, which is, I think, a very, very big part of this film and maybe one of its more dated elements. I mean, I don't think people are quite having the same relationship with TV in 2020 as they did in the 80s. Like, there was a lot of fear about television, you know, from the 60s to the 80s. I teach media studies. Like, that's a thing that comes up a lot, is this question about how much influence TV and sort of consumption of TV has on people. And this film really, really, really harps on that idea a lot. I mean, the climax of the movie takes place at a TV station that is set up right at the very beginning. You're mentioning the character watching this cable channel and having headaches, having sort of physical reactions to it. So we get a lot of that also. And that is, I don't know, I mean, that's one of the things that I'd love to see in a remake. You know, what is the social media version of that? What is the sort of modern technology version of that? And I don't know exactly how you would do it, but I think there's something there.
Yeah, and the whole presence of this, like, you know, the more I think about it, the messages like the obey and, you know, this is your God kind of thing. It's sort of like the upper, like the ruling class, basically just trying to get to destroy like independent thought. And, I don't know. I feel in a way it's similar to some of his other movies, because it's like, if you wanted to, man, you could. Someone must have written there. How many college papers have been done on this movie, right?
Oh, yeah, I might have done one. Well, no, I didn't see this movie when I was in college, but I'm sure I would have, because I wrote a lot of stuff like that.
Did you really? I would love for you to write something on this movie, Nick. I would read it.
Oh, man, I did film analysis. Like, one of my best was about Alien, and I found some political subtext in that. So, yeah, I think I could probably do a pretty good job with this one. But, yeah, I mean, there's definitely an anti-elite sort of sentiment. It's not just sort of anti-consumerism, anti-television, anti-capitalism, but also this, you know, like a lot of the people that we see as aliens when the glasses get put on are very wealthy, sort of well-to-do-looking people. Like, the guy at the newsstand is... You know, he drives a really nice car and he's wearing a really nice suit. And those were kind of the heroes of a lot of movies in the 80s, like a sort of unrepentant capitalist like that. In a lot of films, those are like the guy that we root for. And in this film, it's the guy we shoot because we know he's part of this alien takeover. One of the things I like that we've talked about a little bit before off air We see a lot of sci-fi movies that are about an alien invasion in progress, like the beginnings of it, how this thing spreads, and, you know, like...
This one's already happened.
Body snatchers. Yeah, like, this is an alien invasion that happened a long time ago, and now we're just sort of waking up to it. And almost like The Matrix did in the decade after this, kind of shows this world where that takeover has already happened, and it's just these few people who wake up. Like, you know, we use the word woke a lot today to describe this coming into political consciousness, and this is literally a movie about the process of becoming woke, right?
Exactly. Yep. That's exactly what it is. And that's all just, you know, the sunglasses are just the device that he uses for people to become woke, I guess. I just like this, Nick, because I feel like carrying on, you made up a good point on the last episode I was listening back, how, you know, while Prince of Darkness kind of falls apart towards the end and there's a bunch of things that you can point out that just kind of really don't work about that movie. But you also mentioned that during this time period, like, think of your run of the mill, like, horror sci-fi movie that was coming out. You know, I mean, it was just a lot of the same, you know, slasher movies or, you know, movies that are just over the top with violence and nudity just to sell tickets. Right. And I really got to give Carpenter props for doing two movies in a row here that I think are pretty high concept films.
Yeah, they are. They're true originals, both of them. I mean, there are not a lot of other movies like They Live. There's definitely not a lot of other movies like Prince of Darkness. That one is way out there. And yeah, I mean, to sort of wrap up this decade where he did all kinds of things, you know, studio romances and comedies and, you know, like one of the most hardcore body horror sci-fi movies ever made. It's definitely an interesting place to end up. We should probably... just because I don't know that we'll have time next episode. So he's got this deal now with Alive Films at the end of the 80s, and they will give him these modest $3 and $4 million budgets to make smaller movies where he has basically complete creative control. So he does Prince of Darkness, he does They Live, and then he has all these projects that he wants to do after this that just never happened. One of them, I believe it's called Shadow Company, and I've read about this script. I would love to read the script. And it's written by Shane Black, who's one of my favorite screenwriters. He hasn't been as great as he used to be lately, but it's co-written by him and Fred Decker, who did The Monster Squad, and I believe he wrote and directed RoboCop 3, a favorite film of our good friend and associate Brian Verderosa.
Oh, my God.
So Black and Decker, they write this script called, I think it's called Shadow Company, and it's this, like, Vietnam zombie movie. It sounds almost like a video game kind of plot where you've got, like, American soldiers facing the undead, and supposedly it's an amazing script and definitely would allow Carpenter to do some of the stuff he's really great at, like siege sequences. I mean, I'm sure it would probably pay tribute to Night of the Living Dead the way some of his earlier films did. And I can't, yes. I've been doing some research about what happened after They Live and how this partnership between Carpenter and Alive Films kind of dissolved. And there was definitely a legal thing that happened. There was a lawsuit that I believe was Carpenter's lawsuit. It kind of sounds like they just decided, no, we don't want to give you this money anymore. And we are going to not let you do the things that you want to do, because there is a period in these 4 years before he does his next studio film that he's kind of dormant. And I don't think that was necessarily by choice. I think it was, you know, there was some legal issues there and something happened, which surprises me, right? Because this film was moderately successful on a modest budget. So why not throw some more money at him and let him do what he wants?
Yeah. And Prince of Darkness made around the same figures as well. So, I mean, their first two pictures in, you know, they spent what, $6 million and made 25 or something like that. I mean, yeah, I don't know. That's that whole period is definitely like a void.
Does he mention anything on the commentary about that?
No, nope. And
might be just something legal, like he's not allowed to talk about it. Because I did. I kind of just Googled around and I wanted to see. Like, I had been hearing about this Shane Black movie for the longest time, about just how good it could have been. And it's kind of this lost Carpenter project that everybody thinks would have just been one of his most notable movies. And like, this would be totally the time to do it. And Black is really hot at this point, and Carpenter's coming off a few successful films, and people kind of know him. He's a known commodity. So I'm not sure why that never happened. I mean, this is the late 80s, early 90s, where big blockbuster action and sci-fi movies are just kind of like the most important thing in the world. Your Aliens and your Terminator 2s and things like that.
Yeah, and this dude just like disappears. You know, but part of it is, I mean, we're looking at his filmography, it's like maybe he just kind of wanted to take a break. I mean, you know, like
he did work hard maybe, in the 80s.
Like maybe he was like, I'm just going to take a couple years off. And I think we should probably mention to our audience that we do have some cool plans for the show. We definitely are going to do another episode on They Live, where we talk about the movie kind of more in a scene by scene fashion, like we've done in the past. But before we move into the 90s, we do have some ideas to go back and cover just some things that Carpenter was affiliated with. Like, I know we've talked about Black Moon Rising, which is a movie I've always been really curious about, and also The Eyes of Laura Mars, just in the interest of having this be the most completest podcast we can be.
But yeah, that don't really want to watch Memoirs of an Invisible Man. You're like putting it off. You're stalling.
You know what's funny? I don't even know if it's that bad. I've only seen it once. I remember it just doesn't feel like a John Carpenter movie to me, is kind of how I felt at the time. And he also didn't put his name on top of it either, because I don't know. Because
Chevy Chase is an asshole and probably didn't let him. I love Chevy Chase, by the way, but he's noted asshole Chevy Chase. I mean, he'll basically tell you that himself.
That is like the funniest thing you could have possibly said, because like, it might be true and I don't know. But
yeah, we'll find out. You know, but yeah, I mean, we do have a lot of other films to talk about. I want to, I've been telling you about this for a while. I want to take a look at Captain Voyeur, which is an early student film that Carpenter did. And of course, we started the show with Dark Star. So I want to take it back to the very, very early days and look at that too. So once we finish up, we'll do another episode and They Live. And yeah, I think we're going to go back in time a little bit and just catch up on some things that we hadn't yet seen. And then also, you know, there's other sort of tangential movies, like you were mentioning Halloween 2, which he did the script for and did the music for. And it's kind of an important film, even though they've thrown out that story as canon in the new trilogy that we're doing. We're also, you know, we'll probably have to do an episode on the next two Halloween movies if we're still doing the show at that point. We might be done by then, because who knows what new releases are going to look like. But yeah, we have more to talk about. I mean, I wouldn't say we're running out of Carpenter films. I mean, there's a lot of films in the 90s and some very notable ones, and a few in the decades after that. But you know, like you said, I think it is important to go back and be the completionist that we are and just catch some of this other stuff that we haven't had a chance to talk about yet.
Yeah, and I think, you know, just to be as true to our name as we are, we are going to have some more episodes that focus more on his music. I know I'd love to do an episode on Lost Themes too, so stay tuned for that. There's a Lost Themes remixed album that I think we could definitely have an interesting discussion about. And then I may even want to highlight just some of the super classic scores. Like, I don't think it would be out of the question to do an episode where you and I talk about the score to, like, Escape from New York. Because we are talking about the movies and the music of John Carpenter. And I think right now we're just so excited to be going through these movies and talking about the movies and then touching a little bit on the music. But I think we could dive a little bit deeper into that as well. And but yeah, that is crazy, because once we do get back on the chronological train, man, we are already into the 90s. And in the 90s, you have only a handful of movies. I mean, you have Memoirs, In the Mouth of Madness, Village of the Damned, and Vampires. Is it just those four?
And Escape from L.A., you're forgetting the very memorable Escape from L.A. And then, of course, there's Body Bags, and then, well, it's, no. Yeah,
Body Bags 93.
Yes.
Yeah, you're going to, yeah, I'm telling you right now, I'm going to make this prediction on air so people can go back into the annals of our history and hear me say this. But I think you are going to be pleasantly surprised when you rewatch Escape from L.A., I've told you about this movie club that I'm in where we all watch movies in a synchronized fashion and just group message each other while we watch them. We did Escape from L.A. last week, and I've got to tell you, everybody I watched that movie with had a blast with it. And in fact, two out of three of them said they liked it even better than Escape from New York.
Whoa.
And there's not... Yeah. And here's the thing. They're not the only ones out there that feel that way. I kind of like both those movies equally, but they just have such radically different tones to them that's why I can't decide which one, but it depends on what kind of movies you like. And if you're into a different kind of movie, I think you're going to be pleasantly surprised just because the cast is awesome and it's just fun.
Steve Buscemi, I'm ride or die for Escape from New York. That is my third favorite Carpenter movie. By the way, another thing that we will do before we're completely done here is we need to rank everything. We need to just like hunker down and do it. And it's a tough thing. And you know, it's like picking which one of your children you love the best or something like that. But I've got my top three. I want to like have a completely annotated ranked list of all the Carpenter films. Can't wait to get to Cigarette Burns. We'll do his Masters of Horror episodes. So much stuff to come up in the future here. We are nowhere near done, even though we're almost done with the 80s. Chris, any final thoughts for this episode on They Live, or should we save it all for 2 weeks from now?
I think I'm good for now. I am very excited to... I'm going to watch the movie again and take notes so I can talk about it in a semi-professional manner.
I already did, and I'm going to take more notes, so that might end up being a knockdown, drag-out, like, four-hour episode, but we'll try to keep it contained. We would love to hear back from you, our listeners. We've gotten some great feedback lately. We really, really appreciate hearing from you. Email us or contact us on Facebook or something like that. We just really, really enjoy just knowing how we're doing, and we love ideas for future episodes. We've heard a few of those already that I think even stuff that we haven't mentioned just now. But yeah, get in touch with us. Let us know what you want to hear and what your thoughts are on this film and the others and other things you'd like us to talk about. If you'd like to get a hold of us via email, we are at precinct13podcast@gmail.com. We are on Twitter @13precinct, facebook.com/13precinct, and our website where you can download all of our episodes is precinct13.simplecast.com. We would love for you to subscribe to the show. We would love for you to leave us a review on iTunes or wherever else you download podcasts, and we will keep coming back to you with plenty of Carpenter content. I think Chris just laid out a few months worth of work for us, and I'm looking forward to it very much. So
we'll have to update the itinerary.
Yeah, well, why not? You know, the show is an organic thing. It's like The Thing, you know, it changes to be whatever it needs to be. And that's how it hides out, and that's how it destroys the world. So that's our ultimate goal is world takeover. So we will continue with that in 2 weeks for our second part of They Live.